Boy, just looking at it. I looked at it too, saw how it shone in the light from the lamp above us, saw how cold and shiny and beautiful it was. This light is one of the two things you can't sell. He gave it a quick toss, just as he'd done with the cigarette, and caught it, closed his fist tight around it. The other's where we are right now, where our retarded child is sleeping, where our youngest son is sleeping, and where our other two daughters is sleeping, and all that's around us all, right here. He tapped hard the tabletop. This place is what you can't sell, and you and I both know that's the only hard dollars you'll ever find. Won't be by selling jar to jar your pickled okra or a raggedy-ass pair of bib overalls, not that way.
Leston. Tears were already coming because what he was saying was right. There was true sorry I was feeling, but a sorry colored with the fact I could see no other way away from here than what I knew he was about to say. Leston. I reached a hand across the table toward him. He shook his head.
No tears. This is what you want to have happen, and this is what will have happen.
He paused. His eyes finally left me. Seemed to wander around the room, finally settling on the empty space on the wall opposite him.
Soon as Brenda Kay's set, soon as you're set, I'll put this place I built for us, the land and all, I'll put it up for sale.
He stopped, held the lighter up to the light again.
But this is something you are not ever going to get. It'd fetch a good few dollars, and Lord knows there's reason for getting rid of this thing.
He paused, still looking at it, and I thought I could see his eyes glistening, ready to give way to tears of his own.
Lord knows that I've been thinking on this lighter, and it occurs to me there's good reason to get the hell rid of it. Because having this thing goes to remind me I couldn't even keep my second son around me. Couldn't keep him near to home, to give us a hand when we needed it. And of course that leads right on into my firstborn and how he wouldn't stay around neither. And of course every time I light it up I'm reminded of how my baby daughter was near burned to death because of this little machine.
He paused again, took a drag from the cigarette. He didn't inhale this time, only let the smoke right out.
Reason enough to get rid of the thing.
He held the lighter with two fingers and looked at me.
But you're never going to get this. Now you watch. You come with me and you watch.
He turned from the table, started toward the kitchen door. I got up, followed him to where he stood with the door open now, cool night air on my face. Fresh and welcome in a room that seemed to want to suffocate me. He stepped out off the porch and I went outside, looked out into the darkness. The only light out there was that cast from behind me, the same as on the night Cathedral'd come to warn me about this life I was leading right now, to warn me about the hardship having Brenda Kay would be. True to her word and true to God's promise, here I was. And here were our lives. And I still couldn't see how this was him smiling. Leston turned round at the bottom of the steps, held up the lighter, though I could barely make it out.
You saw me light the last cigarette with this, but you're not getting it. You won't sell this. It will always be mine, Jewel. Miss Jewel Hilburn, this will always be mine.
He held the lighter in his hand like a stone, like he was about to skip it across water, and then he cocked back that arm, and with everything this 50-year-old man had, he threw it hard and clean out into the dark, his body swinging around with the momentum it made. He threw the lighter farther, I was certain, than anything he'd ever thrown. And with it went the burning in me, and the weight on me. Even the smells in the house seemed suddenly gone. Gone with the strong arm throw of my husband, and I saw the perfect sense in him, saw the clear-eyed wisdom of his throw. The lighter lost now to the darkness of the woods out there and to everything we'd ever been. Lost, too, to everything ahead of us. Leston stared out into the dark for a long while, bent over with his hands on his knees, his chest heaving with the effort. Then I saw the cigarette drop to the ground beneath him. Thought I could see the small ribbon of smoke sneaking up from it. I went down the steps, took hold of one of his arms, then half pulled, half pushed him inside and up the stairs and on into bed, where we slept as though we had died, passed on from this world and into the next. On the 1st of August, we sold the house, got $6,700 for it, and the 180 acres around it. More money than we'd seen come through our hands in the last 5 years. One of the owners of the ice cream plant bought it all, a short, fat man who'd never had a farm in his life, and who said he admired the craftsmanship he found in Leston's work. He'd given us the money within the week, told us we could move out any time that month. Leston traded in our old pickup and bought a car for the trip, a brand-new 1952 Plymouth that pleased him no end. The day before we were to move, Billie Jean surprised us, marrying a young man I hardly suspected she was serious about. Gower Cross was a plump man whose face seemed too red and he smiled what I figured was entirely too much, but he was a salesman for a tractor-trailer operation out of Jackson. All that smiling, I figured, just went with the job. When he and Billie Jean told us the news, I took hold of her and started crying. Crying at the shock of it, at the grief of it, at the joy. Another of my children had been taken away from me. 3 down now. The family growing smaller, it seemed, with every day. That night we slept on mattresses on the floor, and near morning a storm rolled in. Filled the house with low thunder and the soft call of summer rain, chilling down the air around us all. At 5 we got up, washed our faces, ate cold biscuits and sausage I'd cooked the night before, and we left. The children had barely woken up, were already on their way back asleep as we backed away from the house, the front of it suddenly lit up brighter than any day I'd ever known by the headlights of our new car. I looked to Leston, his arm across the top of the seat, his head turned as he backed out. I looked again to the house, watched it go dark as we turned, the headlights poking out at first the heavy green forest, then the road before us, and I could feel my heart picking up, the fear in it and the clear hope, and I looked at Leston again. He stopped, shifted gears. Before he gave it the gas, he turned to me, smiled, though I could barely make out his face in the dark, could see beneath the brim of his hat only the hint of his mouth, the corners up. "Miss Jewel Hilburn?" I smiled. "Yes." "Miss Jewel Hilburn, we're taking care." "Yes, I guess we are." He gave the pedal a push and we were off, headed for California in our brand new 52 Plymouth. New clothes and old suitcases in the trunk, my retarded daughter settled between my last 2 children in the back seat. I turned, saw all of them with their heads back, mouths open in sleep. And I saw beyond them, out the rear window and fast disappearing in the distance we were putting behind us, the house. No dust swirled up behind us for the quiet rain we'd gotten, and I kept my eye on our old home till I lost it for the trees and bushes, and all else green there in Mississippi. '52. We stopped in Big Spring, Texas, and saw James and Eudine for the first time since he'd brought his bride home just after the war. James was a veterinarian now, and they had a 3-year-old daughter I'd never seen, Eudine already expecting their second. Brenda Kay remembered Eudine, hollered out,
"You fat."
"You're telling me, sweetheart," Eudine laughed, then hugged her tight. James and Leston and Wilman were all shaking hands, eyes meeting only for a moment or so before darting out at the flat desert prairie. That night we ate too much, slept covering up all the floor space. Our leaving the next morning was filled with kisses and crying and fussing over when we might see each other again. filled too with the deep and shiny ache I carried in my heart when I'd had to surrender my grandbaby Judy back to her mother. We loaded up, Leston put the car in gear, and we were gone. We drove on through desert and farmland, the farmland given out after we drove past the green sign entering Los Angeles County. And then we were in the city, on the freeway, built up high off the ground so that it was like we were floating above everything. Cars all cutting in on one another, brake lights rearing up red, then moving right along. Then the freeway ended, and we drove to the bottom of a ramp and back down onto streets. Around us now, more buildings and more cars and more stores and more what have you than I'd seen in my whole life. New Orleans is only a stick in the mud compared to this. Annie called out when we passed Los Angeles City Hall, and Wilman reached across and honked the horn, put a hand out the window and waved, "Hello, Los Angeles City Hall!" "Wilman!" Annie stretched his name all out in how embarrassed she was and shrank back away from the window. Brenda Kay slept. My baby daughter had arrived, sweaty and hot and asleep in the promised land. Burton wore gray coveralls, the name Bert stitched in green thread above the chest pocket. He met us that night at the hotel he'd recommended to us, and though he was older by only a year since I'd seen him drive away in his pickup, he was a man. He was already burrowed down into the real world, already dug in for the long fight he had the rest of his life to try and win. He helped us dig in those first few days, helped us get settled in. I called the National Association for Retarded Children from a payphone at a gas station near the motel one afternoon that first week there. When the woman answered, I'd sputtered out all it was I had to say, 3 years' worth of words ready to go. She had to cut in to explain to me that they were what she called an umbrella organization. They kept up with research and so forth. I couldn't hear for a moment, deafened by the sound of 3 years of hope leaving me. Then her voice came through. I suggest you visit the people out at the Exceptional Children's Foundation located at 2151 Adams Boulevard, just before you hit Western. After some preliminary testing, they might very well enroll your child there. I had no problems finding the place. Just as the office girl at NARC had told me, it was off Western, which I'd taken down from Pico and just followed light to light to light until I hit Adams, then turned right. They were nice homes, set back farther on the lots than most houses I'd seen since we'd moved here. Houses with green lawns and flower beds and bushes, honeysuckle and climbing roses and palm trees. The houses were older, you could tell by the gingerbread and touches they had, and had seen a better time than right now. But most all of them were in fine shape, positively better than the houses we could afford, not to mention the hotel we were living in for the time being. I wondered as I crawled the car along, looking for 2151, how pleasant it'd be to live here. Then I spotted it, a gray house with white trim, a big porch out front, almost like what you might find back in one of the finer homes in Purvis. The second story had dormers poking out, and in the front yard stood a magnolia. A magnolia. I parked the car and got out and opened the door for Brenda Kay. "Let's come on now, Brenda Kay. There's people to meet." I held her hand tight, felt my palms begin to go wet, and I pulled her up. Brenda Kay turned in the seat and placed her white shoes out onto the curb and stood. I said, "Now give us a smile here." I reached to her hair, tucked a single thin strand of it back behind her ear. "Let's see a smile," someone said from behind me. I quick turned, startled at the sound of a different voice out here. A nigger woman stood there on the sidewalk in front of our baby carriage. She was looking at Brenda Kay, smiling, and I could feel my own smile trying to come up on me, trying to make its way onto my face. I said, "Good morning." She nodded, our eyes meeting and holding a moment. She was a high yellow,
but it was her hair I saw and took in first. Straight, bobbed under at her shoulders, parted at the top in the middle. Then I saw what she had on. A pale lavender dress, pearl buttons up the front, a lavender belt at her waist, the skirt of the dress all flounced out and full, and she had on lavender high-heel shoes. She said, "You, of course, are with the foundation." Still smiling, she nodded toward Brenda Kay. "We're happy you folks are here." But her words weren't meaning much to me just then. I only watched lips moving, saw she wore deep red lipstick, saw, too, she had on rouge and that her eyebrows had been penciled in. "Yes, we are," I said. "At least we're about to be, that is, with the foundation." "Mississippi," she said, and leaned back a little, nodded to the rear of the car. "I saw your plates. My grandfather was from Mississippi, up around Oxford, I think." "Oh," I said, "we're from Purvis, down near to Hattiesburg." I found my breath was slow and shallow, me here on the street and talking to a nigger woman I'd never seen before, just passing the time of day, and her wearing clothes I'd never imagined I might wear. Lavender shoes.
"Mama," Brenda Kay said.
I felt like a word was some sort of salvation, her demanding of me my attention, and I'd forced my smile again. "We've got to be getting to the foundation," I said.
"Nice to see you," she nodded.
She pushed the carriage along again, a carriage shiny and new, the wheels as they turned making no sound at all. And suddenly I saw a picture of Cathedral, barefoot on the road out from the old house in Mississippi, one or another of her boys when they were babies, bundled up in an old quilt and tied off on her back. A papoose there as she walked. From across the street, another woman's voice shouted, "Dorinda, how's little Leon?" I looked, saw on the porch of a red brick house another nigger woman, this one in a bathrobe printed with all kinds of flowers. She had her arms crossed against her chest, her hair cut short and curled. Her skin was a little darker than the one with the carriage, and I could see her smiling, her white teeth. The one pushing the carriage, this Dorinda, called out, "He's doing just fine. Little of the croup, but nothing this fresh air won't help." "You call me, girl," the other woman hollered. I watched as she went to the edge of the porch, stepped down to the concrete walk that went up the middle of the lawn, and bent over, picked up the newspaper lying there. "In a while," Dorinda called out, still pushing the carriage. The woman with the robe waved, went back up on the porch and disappeared inside. They lived here. I took Brenda Kay's hand, my eyes looking everything over, wondering what could go on in this neighborhood. What caused niggers to live this way? Each step I took seemed filled with a new and uneasy feeling as though the world were breaking up beneath us as we moved. Then we came to 2151 and I stopped, looked to left and right. This was it. The place where whatever'd start next in our lives was gonna start. I took Brenda Kay's hand, held it tight, and we started up the walk, moved up the three steps and onto the porch. Next to the door was a brass plaque, not much different than the one Leston and I'd walked up to and read at Dr. Baskett's office in New Orleans all those years back. But now we were at 2151 Adams. And this plaque was shiny and looked new and held out to me a whole barrel full of promise, not like the somber fear Dr. Baskett's old and tarnished plaque had given me. This plaque read, "The Exceptional Children's Foundation, Nathan White, Director." We were small, I suddenly saw, me only a cracker from Mississippi showing up here to the door with my retarded child, my Brenda Kay. And so I reached up a hand to the leaded glass, hesitated a moment longer, just one more moment of this life, because who knew what would come next? Who knew, other than God up in heaven, what would come next? I knocked. I looked at Brenda Kay, saw that single strand of hair falling back out of place. How could I have missed it when I'd pulled back her hair this morning? I wondered, and I reached up, tucked it back behind her ear again, her eyes straight ahead, mouth still tight closed. My hand still there at Brenda Kay's hair. The front door opened wide, and there stood yet another nigger woman, this one young and beautiful, high cheeks and a fine straight nose. Her hair was pulled back tight into a bun, and she had on makeup, too, and was smiling at us. I took my hand down from Brenda Kay's ear like I'd been caught red-handed at something. I said, "We'd like to see Mr. White, if we could." She stepped back from the door, opened it even wider, and made a sweeping gesture with her free hand to lead us in. "Please," was all she said. She closed the door behind us, Brenda Kay's hand in mine now, and said, "Do you have an appointment?" I turned, faced her. "No, actually, we do not." I glanced at the floor, sparkling hardwood, buffed and polished and gleaming. A shaft of morning light fell in through a window to my right and lit up the wood, and I could see in the air dust motes sailing and sailing just hanging there in the air. "Well, then we'll see if we can't get you in to see him." She paused and I looked up, saw she was looking at Brenda Kay. "My name's May," she said to her. Brenda Kay looked at me a moment, just like she always did, then back to the woman. "This here is Brenda Kay Hilburn," I said, and reached out, touched my daughter's arm. "I'm her mama, Miss Jewel Hilburn. We just moved here not a long time ago, a couple of months. The people over to the National Association for Retarded Children said we'd do best to come see y'all." "Hey," Brenda Kay said and smiled. Then she looked at me, said, "Feed your mama," and she turned back to May. "No," I said to her, "not Cathedral." I was surprised at how she'd remembered her from 3 years past. There hadn't been talk of her even allowed in our house. I turned to the woman, saw she had a puzzled look behind the smile she held. I smiled, said, "She's talking about Cathedral, a nigger woman who took care of her when she was little, back in Mississippi." She lost the smile as soon as that word "nigger woman" crossed my lips, and I knew right then it was the wrong word, though I'd never in my life felt any kind of embarrassment at uttering it. But I knew it was the wrong word, here in the foyer of a fine home in Los Angeles in a nigger neighborhood, a foyer suddenly too much like Missy Cook's old place in Purvis. A few feet away, a staircase ran up to a landing at a window that looked, I imagined, out onto the backyard, and I thought a moment on seeing my and my mama's clothes burned in the pecan orchard back of Missy Cook's house, and on my mama's rocker going up in flames, too. To my left was what looked like it'd been a dining room, big windows looking out on the front yard, chairs spread against the walls. To my right was a smaller room with a big oak desk, on it stacks of paper, a blotter, a telephone, a lamp. Next to it, on a smaller table, was a typewriter. As I took all this in, I realized what I was really doing, avoiding the eyes of this woman, May. "Okay," May said. She turned from us, headed into the room with the desk. Once behind it, she smiled again, pointed to the room behind us where the chair sat. "You can have a seat, and we'll see what we can do." I nodded, smiled, turned to Brenda Kay. We two moved into the dining room, and I sat on the smallest, hardest chair I could find, some sort of punishment I couldn't figure out why I was giving myself. From where I sat, I had clear view into the parlor across the foyer, and to May, who was half turned from us, the telephone to her ear. She was talking low into it, and then she stopped, listened a moment, nodded. She had a pen in her hand, was writing something on a piece of paper on the desktop. Then she smiled, her eyes on the piece of paper in her hand, and said one more word, hung up the phone. "Mr. White will see you now," she said, and stood. "He's only got a few minutes while the children finish up with morning exercise, then he'll have to be back in the classroom." I stood, went to Brenda Kay, still at the tree, and took hold her hand. Then we were in May's office, her leading us to a door to my left. She opened the door for us, and our eyes met, the two of us smiling, and for one last moment I wondered whether this Mr. White himself was a nigger. The irony of his name right there in my face, Mr. White, and I wondered if that wasn't what she'd been smiling at all along. I led Brenda Kay into a room with potted plants all around, in the windows and against the walls, and there in the center of the room sat a desk bigger than May's, Mr. Nathan White perched on the corner of it. He was white. Too white, in fact. He was pale and thin, his forehead high and pasty. He had the thinnest mustache, too, and wore a white dress shirt and red tie, tan vest and pants, and I couldn't help but feel as we walked into the room for the very first time that here was a white boy out to impress us with his maturity and poise, what with the way he sat there on the desk. "Be seated," he said, and pointed to two chairs in front of the desk. I led Brenda Kay to the chairs, and we did as we were told. Sat down, me on the edge, my back as straight and proper as I could make it, knees together, hands on my purse and my lap, Brenda Kay leaning forward in her seat, her hands clasped. I said, "This is Brenda Kay Hilburn. She's 8 years old, 9 in October. I'm Jewel Hilburn. We moved here 2 months ago from near Purvis, Mississippi." I paused. He smiled, nodded sharply. "Briefly, let me tell you what we're about. We will test your child, let you know what level we perceive her learning abilities might reach. We test our children each year, determine areas in which they might excel, and we teach them. There are two classes here, one for the younger children, like your Brenda Kay, a class taught by Mrs. Becky Hamby, in whom I have all faith. The second class consists of older children, teenagers. I teach them. We are both authoritative and gentle in our approach, firm and careful." Brenda Kay's eyes were gone wandering, looking at the plants and the pots around the room. "You go ahead and have a look around," he said. "Go on, Brenda Kay. You can touch them if you want." Her eyes shot to his when he'd said her name, and now she was looking at me. I nodded, and she stood right off, walked around his desk, and went to a plant with pale purple leaves hanging in a basket from the ceiling. She was in the sunlight now, Mr. White's back to her, and she touched leaves here and there, just fingered them. "If I may," he said, "I would encourage you to enroll her as soon as possible, Mrs. Hilburn. That will allow us to begin that lifelong process of learning as much as she possibly can. As much as her level of retardation will allow." I meant to ask him the question all these plants, all these shiny hard wooden oak furniture and the fine rugs on the floor had screamed for me to ask. How much would enrollment cost? But now he was off the edge of the desk, swooping toward me. "I suppose you'll want to know who I am. I'm a philanthropist. I make no bones about saying that. There's no pride in my revealing this fact, no boast. I come from upstate New York, studied business management in school, but I found that the sort of business I was most interested in involved helping retarded, well, what I call exceptional, of course, hence the name of the foundation, children." He paused. "I had a retarded brother, a younger brother, and I can remember his being brought home from the hospital and my parents staying up and weeping all night long for weeks. They've finally placed him in an institution, my younger brother only a month old. That was the beginning of the journey that's ended here. We as a family made it a point to visit him once a month. It was a fine institution, physically sound and with a caring staff, and we loved him. Gave him cookies and candy when we came, spoke carefully and lovingly to him, touched him, hugged him, and smiled at him. Still, it was an institution in which he lived every day. And over the years, I began to see in my brother's eyes a certain spark, a certain unspeakable something deep inside him, I believe, went untapped. And when he died at age 21, I grieved. I grieved not for my mother or my father, or my older sister or myself. I didn't grieve for any of us." He paused, and he was off the desk now, and sat in the empty chair next to me, leaned close to me. "What I grieved for was that spark, that undeniable spark behind his eyes, in his eyes, that had gone untapped.
I didn't know what that spark meant, didn't know what it might have meant, but it was gone. He finished, and I brought my eyes from his, settled them on my hands holding my purse, at my old hands here in front of me. Then I looked at Brenda Kay. She stood at the window, had both hands up to the glass. She was looking out at something in the side yard of the place, then turned to me, the sun falling in on her to light up her face. She pointed a finger to the glass.
Mama, look! Maytoes, Mama!
She smiled, and I thought I too could see a spark of some kind in her eyes, her green eyes illuminated by the sun so that the color'd become gem-like, green and light.
Tomatoes, that's right, Brenda Kay,
Mr. White said and stood, went to her at the glass.
That's another of our projects here. In addition to class time and exercise, we also work on our garden out there. Cherry tomatoes, for some reason, seems to be the vegetable of choice for these youngsters.
He put an arm on Brenda Kay's shoulder. She didn't flinch, didn't even move, as though already she'd known who this man was and why he was here. I am convinced that there is a spark in each child. That may be a simplistic view of the world, may even be ridiculous. Some retarded children never learn to wipe their noses, never learn to chew food. Perhaps for those the institution is needed, but not for the children to whom we address ourselves here at the Foundation. He paused, placed his hands in his pockets. Now what do you think? I took in a breath, not ready for him to turn this around to me. I'd been listening, hearing his words, words that made sense to me, but words so forward, his handing them all out to me so abrupt and straight, that the only words ready in my head left me just as quick. You're a pompous man, I said. But right. He laughed out loud and long, leaned his head back and laughed and shook his head. Brenda Kay turned quick to him, and then she started to laughing too. Her filling up whatever room for laughter was left in here. And I felt myself begin to smile. He said, "Thank you, Mrs. Hilburn. Thank you." He came around the desk, held out his hand for me to shake. "And I'll expect you and your daughter here tomorrow morning at 8 for her first set of tests and for enrollment." I finally stood, glad to be out of the chair. I took his hand, a hand that seemed too frail in mine, and we shook. "Enrollment," I said. I felt my smile leave. Now was the time. Enrollment. How much will that cost? He stopped shaking my hand, but still held it. He said, "What you can afford, you pay. Remember, I'm a philanthropist. Pay only what you can afford." He turned from me, started toward the door. "Brenda Kay," I said, "come on, honey, let's go." I held my hand out to her, the same hand I'd shaken with Mr. Nathan White, philanthropist, just held it out to her. She came around the desk to me, then we were standing before the closed door, Mr. White with his hand at the doorknob, ready to pull it open. He smiled at me. "One last item," he said. "The word nigger. It's an outmoded word, to say the least." "Oh," I said, and felt my face blush. "Don't worry," he said. "There's simply the word colored, or the word Negro. By no regards, new words, certainly, but ones we employ here. I hope you understand." "Yes," I said, "yes." And then I felt something settle over me, a calm I took and wrapped myself in, Brenda Kay's warm hand in mine. He smiled again and pulled the door open, followed us out to where May, the colored girl, sat. She was on the telephone, but smiled up at us anyway. Mr. White leaned over the desk, took a pencil and a piece of paper from the desktop, scribbled something on it. She read it, nodded at him even though she was in the middle of a sentence. Mr. White turned to us, quick glanced at his watch again. "May here will fill you in on what we'll expect tomorrow. how long the testing will take, etc.
If you wish, you may take a look in either of the classrooms for a moment, just to give you a concrete glimpse into what happens here.
He was already on his way up, two steps at a time.
Now, Mrs. Hilburn, May said from behind me. I turned to her, saw her smiling, nowhere in her face any show of that word I'd used, the one I'd been raised on, the one that never meant anything wrong in my life, but a word I knew starting then I'd try my best to keep from speaking. She said, "Let me have your address and home phone number to start with."
When we were done filling out the paperwork, May told us how to get to the classroom that, starting tomorrow, would be Brenda Kay's. The door was closed, and so I let go Brenda Kay, leaned my ear close to the door, and heard a woman's voice. No other sound than that. I smiled, looked at Brenda Kay. She smiled at me, and I reached a hand to the door, quietly knocked. "Come in," came the voice. I reached down, turned the knob, slowly opened the door. There were things about that moment I will always remember. The teacher, her blonde white hair parted on the side, curled under just where it reached her shoulders. Her standing in front of a blackboard, the big storybook she held in her hands, the pages facing her audience. And there was the smile she gave to us, the nod. But of course, it was the children, and the slow turn of all their heads to us that I would carry with me from then on. Kids with black hair and blonde, red and brown. Kids with freckles and teeth and no teeth and no glasses. New clothes and old clothes. Even some nigger children. And all of them children. I figured here for the same reason. Parents who loved them. Parents who held out hope.
"We have visitors," the teacher said. "I'm Mrs. Hamby, and you are?"
"Miss Hilburn, and this is Brenda Kay. Brenda Kay Hilburn, my daughter." Brenda Kay only stood there looking at all the children, and I tried to imagine for a moment what she might think, might feel at suddenly seeing all these children so like her, so in need of all we could give them. But I could come up with nothing, could think of no one but myself and the joy of this moment, this fine start.
Our 10 years in California. Brenda Kay tested in that first year at a 4-year-old's level of intelligence. We bought a small house, a 3-room thing in the Mar Vista area of what they called the town of Venice, though calling anything out here a town seemed ridiculous. It was all just one big city. But I had my own kitchen again, and I cooked steaks with home fries and corn on the cob for our first dinner in our new house. Mr. White taught me that nigger was what he called an outmoded word, one that should be replaced with colored, and I taught Annie and Wilman. Whenever Leston used the word nigger, I just said the word colored to him, nothing more, but enough from me to let him know I didn't approve of its usage in our home, our new home. I got a job at the Hughes cafeteria, my experience in the grammar school cafeteria coming in handy. Leston worked driving truck for Pico Furniture, money coming at us. Even though Leston was 52 years old by then, a man too old for standing and lifting and carrying furniture. Every night I'd had to rub his back down with Ben Gay, his flesh never building up the way it might have were he a younger man, what with all that exercise and work, and I'd had to rub and rub and rub until he fell asleep under my hands. Brenda Kay brought home a pencil holder she'd made out of an old Campbell soup can and a swatch of wallpaper. Wilman graduated Venice High. Got on at Pico Furniture, Leston and him working together and moving furniture anywheres from up to the Hollywood Hills on down to Long Beach. Burton married one Sarah Kaminsky, a Jewish girl he'd met on a blind date set up by Wilman and his girlfriend at the time, a
A girl who wore her hair cut way short above her shoulders and who seemed not to like me at all, though she wanted me to think she adored me. The two of them married by a judge in Santa Monica so there'd be no conflicts about any kind of ceremony, whether Jewish or Baptist, though we lost the practice of attending church or Sunday school since we'd moved here. Brenda Kay's teacher asked me to step in for her one afternoon for arts and crafts when she had to tend to a dentist's appointment, and I'd had them all gluing popsicle sticks together into whatever shapes their hearts desired. Annie had a string of boyfriends a mile long through high school, all of them pretty boys with handsome hard jaws and crew cuts and plaid shirts and khaki trousers, and it seemed like we saw each one no more than 3 times apiece. Then she'd run in from that third date all crying, falling apart, and it'd be my role to go into her room, pat her on the back, console her, and agree with her about the stupidity of men, though I hadn't yet seen a man around the house looking for her. Just pretty boys. Mr. Nathan White hired me on as assistant to the smaller children, and I quit working the cafeteria. Took to bringing in the papier-mâché and colored macaroni and red clay. I don't know exactly how many coil vases and ashtrays and paperweights and doorstops and unidentifiable other clay whatnots we made over those 10 years. Hundreds, probably. All variations on the same old idea. Get them working with their hands, make something they could hold on and think, I made it, and have it be the truth. For that, all those red coils of clay were worth it. Dirt well spent. Leston and Wilman both lost their jobs when Pico Furniture closed up and declared bankruptcy, and Leston got a job as a maintenance man over to El Camino College in Gardena for $37 a week. Wilman went down to the unemployment office in the hopes of only collecting money so he could lay out on the beach. Instead, they made him go over to Watts to the Royal Crown Cola Company and apply for some job called truck sales, a job involved driving store to store and selling soda pop. Knee-high Royal Crown, party pack, off the truck and filling store shelves with it, a job he promptly got. Started at $52 a week, him still living at home. Brenda Kay, at age 12, tested in at age 5. James and Eudine had their third baby, David, company to the other two, Judy and Mark. Billie Jean had first Elaine, then Matthew back in Jackson. Gawa transferred up there when the Purvis dealership closed down. Brenda Kay and the rest of her class made handprint ashtrays. Hers kept filled by Leston so that I had to empty it each morning before Brenda Kay and I headed up to the foundation in the second car we had, an old 49 Chevrolet Burton rounded up at Bundy. Wilman met a girl named Barbara Holmes while he and his cronies from high school were out one Saturday night to the ballroom at the end of Santa Monica Pier to see Spade Cooley. Wilman and Barbara danced, then gone over to the Clock Drive-In where he told me the next morning she wouldn't let him kiss her. This Barbara Holmes, a Baptist girl from East Texas whose daddy was an actor himself and who'd been in a few movies, even with John Wayne one time. They married 8 months later at a church wedding in Culver City, to which Wilman had been late because of his route taking too long that day. The two of them honeymooned up to Las Vegas just over the weekend, Wilman back at work Monday morning, Barbara back to work at the telephone company where she was an operator. Mr. Nathan White talked the health department down in Redondo Beach into giving up its old storeroom to him, there being now 32 children holed up each day in the foundation's house on Adams. I was in charge of organizing the carpool down there in the South Bay, each of us mothers trading off driving, though I was there each day one way or the other. Burton and Sarah had Susan, Wilman and Barbara had Brad, and those two traded having children for the next few years. Baby girls to Burton, baby boys to Wilman, Jeannie, then Robert, then Jill, then Timmy. Brenda Kay, at age 14, tested in at age 6. Leston was made supervisor of the heating and cooling plant at El Camino, and I talked him into selling off the house in Mar Vista for something farther down the coast. Our lives now moving south from Los Angeles, what with Leston in Gardena, me and Brenda Kay in Redondo Beach. We made $3,000 off the house in Mar Vista, bought a two-bedroom bungalow off 6th Street and Ingleside in Manhattan Beach, not three blocks from the ocean. Mr. Nathan White put me in charge of yet another of his big ideas. The families of all the exceptional children in the Redondo Beach class saving up blue-chip stamps in order to buy a station wagon. A year and a half later, in December 1959, we had enough for the station wagon, and I had another aspect of my job, driving that station wagon each morning and picking up the children, driving them home each afternoon. One morning, not long after we got the station wagon, a little girl named Candy pushed a lunchbox out the window. All I saw of it was a sort of a small explosion in the rearview mirror, a sandwich and chips and apple all flying up into the grill of the car behind me. After that, the windows were kept rolled up, all except mine. Leston was promoted to head of maintenance at El Camino College and started wearing polished wingtips and a tie to work. James did what he wanted to for a while and gave up being a veterinarian for teaching high school ag in level land just outside Lubbock. Wilman was made the first pre-salesman for Royal Crown, quit driving truck and was given a company car, a black 1960 Rambler, and started driving from store to store and selling from sheets of paper instead of off the truck showing up the next day with whatever the store ordered. Burton quit Bundy, took a job at Royal Crown, and for a few months followed Wilman's Rambler with his Royal Crown delivery truck until he too started as a pre-salesman. Annie graduated Lawndale High School, still followed by that string of boys, but ended up getting married 2 years later to a California highway patrolman 10 years her senior, him having stopped on the New Harbor Freeway for speeding, then writing her up, then asking her out. Billie Jean and the babies came out for Annie's wedding and stayed, Gawa and her having gotten a divorce 2 years before, and Billie Jean holding on to that huge and awful secret all that time. She and Elaine and Matthew stayed, and she took night courses, got a job as a night nurse over to Buena Park Community Hospital in Orange County. Brenda Kay, at age 16, tested in at age 6. Brenda Kay, at age 17, tested in at age 6. Brenda Kay, at age 18, tested in at age 6. Leston came home from work one evening in April, him in his white dress shirt and thin black tie, his black pants and shined wingtip shoes, standing there in our kitchen. Brenda Kay sat at the table, a thick green crayon held tight, her hand swirling out with the greatest of efforts the rows of letters she'd been making for 3 months now, the huge and joyful triumph of them, this row of crooked and backwards letter B's. I understood him when he smiled down at Brenda Kay, touched her hair with one hand, with his other loosened the tie at his throat, then looked at me. A cigarette hung there at his lips like always, across his face a smile that creased his eyes nearly closed. This man, head of maintenance at El Camino College, my husband. He tapped ash into the handprint ashtray Brenda Cade made so long ago. We're moving back. What is there for me to say except I understood him? Because I did. Moving where? But no name had to be uttered. He put the cigarette to his lips again, took one last drag, then stubbed it out in the tray. Home. I was at the counter slicing up a green tomato I'd picked from the small strip of vines that grew along the back of the house. Leston liked the green one sliced up and fried, then spread with mayonnaise and sprinkled with pepper, and I looked from him to the tomato on the cutting board, the knife in my hand. I closed my eyes a moment, opened them, sliced right down and through the tomato, and again. So we can run our lives right back into the ground, run right back to that crack of life we had before? I paused, though I kept cutting away.
And this isn't home? I nodded at Brenda Kay. You see what she's doing there? You think we'd be able to get this far, back where you call home?
We got this far.
We. I wouldn't let my eyes meet his. Instead, stared hard at Brenda Kay wrestling those letters in her head to the paper, fighting hard for them. The crayon nearly snapped in two for how hard she gripped it. But still, I saw him out of the corner of my eye. Saw him looking at me as he pulled the tie on through his collar, slowly folded it up in his hands. That night we lay in bed, me on my side and facing him, but as far away from him as I could get. Leston lay on his back, eyes open, his hands behind his head on the pillow. But she's writing. She got the first letter of her name down so well she don't have to look at the letter B anymore to write it. We can't leave.
You taught her what she knows. You taught her to write that first letter to her name. Just like you taught who knows who all back home how to read and write. You're a teacher. That's you.
I was quiet for a bit. Your job.
My job.
In the light from the small shard of moon through the window, I thought I could see the shine of his eyes, wide open and unblinking, him staring at the dark ceiling above us.
The reason I got my job is because it's nigger work. That's all. I got the position I do because it's a nigger job, and I was only white boy willing to do it. I never told you that.
He rolled onto his side, faced me, and I lost his eyes, saw only a silhouette, the shape of his head and shoulders, then the folds and lines where the blanket and sheet took over. There was that word, right here in our bedroom, the two-syllable one that brought on the specter of our old lives. That shadow never far from us at any given moment, only one word away. I was silent in a darkness that suddenly seemed thick and full.
The man I replaced was a nigger, and he never got to wear a tie and wingtips the whole time he was with the college. Gray uniforms every day. Moses on his shirt every day.
He stopped again, and now I felt myself slowly move over toward him, felt my body go from the comfort of sheets I had already warmed up to a new place in our bed, new terrain. The sheets cold but forgiving, warming up quick enough to where the cold couldn't seep into me. Then Leston's hand was on my shoulder, just resting there.
But it don't matter, because I did it. I did the job. I won and you won. We beat this place. Brenda Kay's near on to writing a name. I wear a shirt and tie to work. We're sitting in a house worth enough money to buy a palace back home.
I closed my eyes, had seen enough, even though the room was dark. What will we do there?
Live, eat, sleep.
He paused.
Fish.
I could see him smile, even through my closed eyes, even through the dark.
I've been in touch with Toxie. He tells me there's a place to be perfect for us. That was when I sat up in bed, started in on the hard fight I was ready for.
Well, you sure got the nerve to go on ahead and start making big plans for this family. You sure got the nerve. Just to who you think you are. You think you're going to lead me by the nose down the primrose path you think moving back to Mississippi's going to be?
There was a silence, then Leston's words were heavy and sharp and black in the room, some huge axe through the darkness.
Talk to me of nerve. Just talk to me of making big plans for a family, about going right ahead and doing what you want for your family. Talk to me of nerve, Miss Jewel Hilburn, and selling off a house bit by bit, sending to magazines for brochures, selling a clock off a wall with nobody's blessing but your own.
Leston rolled onto his back again, put his hands behind his head again, looked at the ceiling again.
I've been here 10 years for you. You railroaded me into this place, and I stayed, and now we beat this place.
He stopped, and still I was breathing hard in and out, because I could see the future already. Saw in the dark hollow, where his eyes ought to be, a place 2,000 miles east of here, where the air was thick and wet and hot, where things moved slowly and carefully right on to their deaths.
It took you 3 years to get me out here. Now I've been here 10, and you are my wife.
The only sound then was me, breathing in and in and in. Only me. And then I swallowed, took one last huge and hard, deep breath, because I understood him. I never knew my husband to be happier. We sold the house 9 days after we listed it, made more money than it seemed we would know to do with. 3 days later, Leston went right out, bought another new car, and when he came home driving a beige four-door with wide white wall tires, I wondered if he weren't just in all ways the child, joyful at things he could drive, a life he could control the way he'd controlled his voice in the dark of our bedroom and the way he'd controlled the lives of his children these long years. James the only one to escape early enough on, and the way he controlled the colored man who worked for him at El Camino, and the niggers back in Mississippi, all of them controlled by him. Except Brenda Kay, of course. Me part and parcel of her. Now we were moving to where he called home, and now I'd seen as he pulled into our driveway that night with the new car, this would be his return in triumph, and his last stand at controlling me. You are my wife. Hilburn and Wife Lumber Company trooping off into the dark, deep woods of Mississippi. Before we'd even left California, Taxi lined up a house for us. A rental house on a bayou near McHenry. A gray wooden house 6 feet off the ground with a porch across the front. In the pictures he sent, the two windows were like empty eyes. Behind the house was the bayou, sawgrass, and water. When we pulled up in front of the house, Tox had gotten things set up for us. There were lights on, inside the windows and coming out through the screen door. Though the light was warm, a soft and smooth yellow, those windows were still empty eyes, the front door only an open mouth. That first month in Mississippi, I lay awake every night, wondering how it'd come about and come about so quick. The open windows above the headboard seemed only a prank there in the dark, the air inside no cooler, no less stagnant than that out on the water and in the woods. The only thing close to movement was the soar and tear of night sounds out there, the tree frogs and cicadas, the sounds louder and more rambunctious than any late-night siren or honking horn I'd heard in Venice or Manhattan Beach. Leston lay next to me, sleeping away. He spent much of each day, as he'd said he would, fishing or crabbing or just tooling around in the Studebaker. Regular country gentleman now. Him with no need for a job and with all the money we had from selling off the house. The white of it was settled into a bank down in Gulfport, waiting for us to find a house we wanted to buy or a parcel of land we'd want to build on. All of it part of his big plan for the end of our lives. I lay awake at nights wondering on how quick we could get back out. There wasn't any doubt in me. We'd be back there and I'd be back to the foundation, back to driving the station wagon, back in the classroom and doing what was necessary for Brenda Kay's life. That, I saw, was what I was doing late nights lying awake. Already fixing this, mending the bone break I'm moving here was. I prayed, me full aware of what prayer could do. I let a minuscule prayer course its way through me. Whatever death it is he's known these 10 years, let him have died enough to see what's best for us. Let him have died enough. And I fought him, gave him grief each day, beginning first thing when I'd show him the 10 or 12 new mosquito bites Brenda Kay woke up with each morning, me leading her into the kitchen where Leston sipped his coffee and rolled his cigarettes. Then I'd stand his baby daughter in front of him, lift the bottom edge of a nightgown and say, "Take a look at these, Leston." The red welts on her scarred skin were an even deeper red than those about her ankles or arms. Then I always turned Brenda Kay around, let her right back out of the room before Leston was able to say a word. But it was Leston to call down God's answer to my prayers, my husband to make happen our moving back to California, though he'd no way to know that was what he was doing. On just one day, my husband put into motion our lives in a way that led to our leaving this place and put us back on the narrow path. One afternoon in July, just after lunch, Leston said,
Thought we could take a little drive. Surprise destination.
But once we were in the car, I wasn't long in figuring out where we were headed. I kept my mouth closed about it, figured I'd let my husband believe in his ability to surprise me for as long as I could. So when we turned left, headed on 13 up toward Carrie's, there was nothing left for me but to sit back, see how he planned to play this out. We drove on through the woods, trees reaching over the highway. Once a little while north of Lumberton on 11, when the trees seemed to stretch out over us for as far ahead as you could see, Brenda Kay hollered out behind us, "Tree tunnel, Mama!" Both Leston and I laughed, him shaking his head, grinning. A mile or so farther on, Leston said, "No doubt you know where we're headed." "You tell me," I said, "this is your surprise." It was as if our having laughed together a few moments before might have happened a year ago, or 10. I looked out my window at a green so thick you could see only a few feet back in, and I thought of my daddy, of him disappearing into the same thick green of a Sunday afternoon in a place not far from here. Not far at all. Because that was where we were headed, back to the old places. The dashboard light popped. I didn't hear him pull it out. A moment later glanced from my window to the dashboard to see it still there. Then I looked at him, at his profile sharp against all this green shooting past him. His hair jumped with the wind in through his open window, the unlit cigarette jammed between the first and second fingers of his right hand holding the wheel, his left arm hanging down out the window. This was my husband. This was Leston. And I swallowed hard because I knew what I was doing. Knew for every second I breathed what I was doing. Fighting him. Trying my best to beat him. I took in a deep breath, held it, looked out the windshield. Afternoon light fell in places through the trees to the road, dappled it with light. My window open too. My hair jumping just as much as Leston's. The air moving round us seemed fresher, the shattered bits of light out there on the blacktop making the drive feel that much cooler. But I knew better, knew this wind through the car was only a brief fix-up of the heat we had to live in, sleep through. The next road we turned off on was an oiled one, a step up on the quality of the lives of those living round here. When we'd lived here, though, it had been just dirt. Now there'd be no dust cloud to follow us, trail us like a hound trying to find some animal on its way back to its nest. The road, too, was a little wider, and by the time we made it to the house, the sun was starting on its way down, the shadows cast on the road, nowhere near as clean and sharp as those on our way here. Leston slowed down, pulled even with the house, cut the engine. "Home," he said. Then Brenda Kay. "Home." I said nothing. Leston turned to me.
"Well, here we are, scene of the crime."
"What crime?"
He was quiet a moment. "Figure speech."
He popped open his door, climbed out. He crossed in front of the car, was already in the yard and headed for the house. I opened my door, stepped out onto the thin grass next to the road. I stood, turned to my daughter.
"You just come along, Brenda Kay. We'll have us a look around here."
Leston knocked at the door, three quick raps that cut through the thick air. Made us stopping in here more an intrusion than it already was, though there didn't seem to be anyone around. No cars. The spots in the yard where grass had been rubbed bare speckled with oil stains. He knocked again, this time harder, slower, but still no one answered. He stepped off the stoop, went to the window to his right, the front room window, and peered in. I let go Brenda Kay's hand, went to the window. Inside was furniture, an old divan, and a chair, the stuffed back of it worn at the center. In one corner there beneath, where the stairs came down, stood an old radio, big and boxy, just like we'd had. And to my right was the fireplace, the hearth, on it a stack of what looked like magazines. Scene of the crime, I thought. These were the stairs I'd been carried down by two colored boys after too many hours of trying to give birth to the 18-year-old girl behind me.
and this was the fireplace, where there'd been a can of lighter fluid left out. My life in a single room. I felt myself suddenly falling into the chasm he'd led me to, felt myself smiling all the way down into a darkness he wanted us to hole up in the rest of our days, that abyss called memory. He wanted me to spend the rest of my life like he and Toxie did every evening he was over, the two of them out on the porch as the sun set behind cypress and oak, them both talking on what they'd done with their days. I looked at the house, took it in, and the way Leston was doing. The clapboards were still the same white, though the paint had blistered up. What little lawn there was out here was trimmed up, short. Whoever lived here at least wanted that much to look nice. But it was our house, I saw. The same one that'd been illuminated by the headlights of the old Plymouth 10 years ago as Leston pulled out and away from our old lives. Wilman and Anne and Brenda Kay all asleep in the back seat, and I fell even deeper, faster toward the point Leston was aiming me for. I smiled, and Leston smiled, and started round the side of the house. Brenda Kay and I followed, the lawn in the side yard just as neat and trim as that in front, and I reached out, touched the side of the house like it was some big and hairy beast. I just touched it, afraid it might move, might jump at me. Memories cascading down on me so hard. To my right was the barn, behind it the repair shed. Neither of them any more broken down now than when Toxie and Sepulchre disappeared in there each morning to fiddle with the engines on the machinery we'd owned. I caught glimpses, too, of the field back behind the shed where we'd kept the cattle before selling it off, and where, later, we'd grown sweet potatoes to sell for medicine for Brenda Kay. Calcium gluconate, I remembered, some sort of drug these backwoods doctors figured on curing mental retardation. And I smiled, shook my head. We were behind the house now, spread out in front of us, the woods into which I'd let Brenda Kay walk just to see where she went. A teenage boy named Burton following behind her, and I remembered him stopping at the edge, kicking the dirt with his toe, him the undercover man. And I shook my head at this too, me smiling. "What's so funny, Jewel?" I turned from the woods to let